Welcome, everyone, to The Demand Side. I'm your host, Edward Brown. We are back with a new season of episodes discussing some of the major political and economic challenges of our time. Today, we will be talking about why our politicians continually ignore economists when determining how to best steer the economy, and how this often leads to widespread economic mismanagement. Here to discuss is our very special guest, Professor Alan Blinder. Professor Blinder is the Gordon Rentschler Memorial Professor of Economics and Public Affairs at Princeton University. Dr. Blinder has served as Vice Chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, where he was a member of the Board's Committee on Bank Supervision and Regulation, Consumer and Community Affairs, and Derivative Instruments. Before his time on the Fed's Board of Governors, Professor Blinder was a member of President Clinton's original Council of Economic Advisors, where he was in charge of the administration's macroeconomic forecasting. Dr. Blinder was previously president of the Eastern Economic Association and vice president of the American Economic Association. He was the founder of Princeton's Griswold Center for Economic Policy Studies, and he has authored or co-authored 21 books, including his latest book, which we will discuss in great detail today, Advice and Dissent: Why America Suffers When Economics and Politics Collide. Professor Blinder, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Professor, we're very happy to have you on today. We are largely going to be discussing your book, Advice and Dissent, a book I encourage all of our listeners to go out and get a copy of because it's so illuminating to our political process and how economies underperform when economics and politics fail to work well together. But before we get started, why don't we have you talk a little bit about the book and why you decided to write about this particular issue?
I think there were two main motivations. There's always 17 others, but two major ones. One was, you know, I'm not a young man, and I've been involved in various ways in either watching, critiquing, participating in the making of, advising on economic policy for a very long time. And I must say, there have been some ups, but I've become increasingly frustrated with the way that good economic advice is routinely shucked aside and bad economic advice is routinely adopted. It's not always. There are happily exceptions to that rule. Thank heaven for that. But it happens all too much. And this book addresses the reasons for that. The second reason, they're related, of course, is I think the American people, or, you know, people in other countries as well, although all my examples in this book are American, don't really understand how policy is made. It's a pretty nuanced story with a lot of moving parts. And I think the understanding of that in the broad populace is minimal. I think that's a generic statement. It could be about foreign policy, health policy, civil rights, lots and lots of things. But what I know about is economic policy.
Right. Yeah, it's a fantastic book. And you know, you start it with a very funny quote. You say politicians use economics in the same way a drunk uses lampposts, for support rather than illumination. and then you go on to say that while there have been instances in which economic reasoning has aided politicians in making wise decisions, like when, you know, Congress deregulated the trucking and airline industries in the 70s and 80s, there are far more instances in which our politicians already know what they want to do, whether good or bad for the economy, and then they simply find some economic theory, whether it's legitimate or not, to use to support their decisions. Yep. Can you talk a little bit about this and a little bit about the lamppost theory and its impact on public policy?
Sure. So the lamppost theory is about using economists or economic advice. Well, maybe it's about not using it all, but if you use it, It's about justifying political decisions. Economists are often uneasy about that, but you can always find, that said, economists exist in all kinds of political stripes, from the far left to the far right. So any politician who looks or has his staff, his or her staff looks, can always find an economist to support any position you can dream up. It could be on the crazy left, it could be on the crazy right. You can always find somebody. And those somebodies are likely, first of all, to say things the politicians want said. And secondly, to say things in ways that get more media attention than the boring middle. Most economists are in the boring middle. And because we're boring, that doesn't make good television and good headlines and things like that. But it often makes good policy. And that's the essential conflict. Another way to put the same point, which I emphasize in the book, is there's often a very big difference between policies that are good for the economy and policies that sound good superficially. They're not always different, but they're very often different.
Right, right. So if policymakers are generally doing whatever they want and using the lamppost theory to justify their decisions, decisions that are often to the detriment of the electorate, then shouldn't we just take economic decision making away from the politicians? Couldn't we take the model of the Fed's Federal Open Market Committee, where a group of professional economists make decisions on the economy, and apply that format to all federal economic policy? Or is that too extreme? Would that, you know, chip away at our democracy?
I think it is too extreme. I did use the Fed in general, the Federal Market Committee as an example, but I think it's way too extreme. We live in a democracy. We, the electorate, elect people to represent us with the hope that they're going to represent us well and do things that will make us better off, not worse off. That's a kind of a democratic ideal. The reality often falls well short of that ideal. But if you really believe in democracy, you don't want to turn everything over to a bunch of technicians. That said, and I discuss this in the book, I believe that we've drawn the line between the realm of technocracy and the realm of political decision making in the wrong place, and moving it a bit, not all the way, as you yourself said, that would be way too extreme, but just moving it a little bit in the direction of more technocratic input or more technocratic decision making and less political. More. But not everything, not anywhere close to everything. I'll give you an example, which I discuss at some length in the book. Imagine that we left the details of writing the tax code not to the politicians that actually write it, but to a team of technocrats. It would be accountants, lawyers, and economists, say, non-political people. And then let them bring the whole thing to the Congress for an up or down vote. If you don't like it, reject it. If you like it, vote it, vote yes.
Yeah.
And I've asked some audiences the following hypothetical question. Do you think we'd get a better tax code that way? The answer is obviously yes. And then the second question is, you need a little bit of political astuteness here, but not much. Is there any chance that the politicians will do this? And the answer is no.
Right.
But I like to hold it up as an example of, and I think you can move a little bit in that direction. You'll never get all the way there. The right. Politicians have control of the tax code. They can use it to dispense favors to the people they want to favor and penalize the people they want to penalize. They're not giving that up.
Right.
But maybe we can move it a little bit.
Sure. So then would one solution be to have more economists hold public office? I mean, if politicians, and we've seen this, you know, take complicated issues and turn them into overly simplistic sound bites like balance the budget or end the Fed, when we know there isn't a single economic theory that is simple enough to be written on a baseball cap, wouldn't a reasonable solution to have more economists run for public office?
That would be nice if there were economists capable of doing that. I know a lot of economists. I've been in this profession forever. And there are hardly any that I would want to see elected to public office. They just don't have the political astuteness, the feel for what the common man and woman actually wants, and the way they think. Regular people don't think like we economists do.
Right.
And we're not going to be able to shove that down their throats. A politician has to be closer to the earth, closer to the electorate. And very few of the economists I know are anywhere near that. I don't even know that I would vote for them. It depends who else was on.
Yeah. Well, let's get into some specifics.
Thing to that, though. I do think if that would happen, you'd get better economic policy.
I think so.
You might get worse lots of other things, but I think you'd get better economic policy.
Yeah, at the expense of other things, sure. In the book, you note that negative sum economic policies are often positive sum political policies, right, and that the conflict between the political and economic calculus goes a long way towards explaining why economic logic so rarely prevails in Congress.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about this?
Sure, because I think it's really a fundamental problem. And going back to your first question, very poorly understood by the electorate. So they don't actually see what they're getting into. So let me do it by an example. We were just talking about the tax code. It is littered, and I pick my verb deliberately, with special interest provisions of all sorts, most of which are understood only by the people that benefit from them and their lawyers and accountants. How do they get in the code? They're put in there deliberately, not by accident, by politicians who know that if they put in these tax favors, the people thereby favored will grow to love them, vote for them, and probably give them political donations. Now, if you think on the other side of the coin, suppose they put in the code a tax provision that is good for $20 million to 10 people. All right, that's $200 million. Just, you know, pick whatever numbers you want. I just want to pick simple numbers. And suppose that it costs $2 to 300 million people. Well, economists do the math and say, that's a really bad idea. A politician looks at the math and say, well, let's see. Those few people that earn all those millions of dollars are going to notice it and be grateful and help me get reelected.
True.
Those 300 million people that lose an average of $2 a piece are, first of all, not even going to know they lost it. And even if they did, even if some economist comes along and say, you know, this terrible thing costs you $2. That's not going to move them to political action. And so that's why the political calculus has an internal logic that many economists don't appreciate. They think it's crazy. It's not crazy. It's crazy from an economic point of view. It's not crazy from a political point of view.
Right. It's strategic politics. Yeah, for sure. You know, keeping that in mind, isn't there, I guess expanding on that, isn't there a sort of an inherent problem with our federalist construct when trying to make national economic policy? Because it seems that if all politics is local and members of Congress are primarily concerned with pleasing the people who sent them to Washington so that they themselves can get reelected, won't national interest always lose out to local interests? I mean, you know, the thing that comes to mind is, you know, the over the last 20 years, people in the Midwest, you know, it's very difficult to explain to people in the Midwest who have seen their jobs automated or shipped overseas that free trade actually creates jobs.
Right.
So is this disconnect something that we have to just, I guess, learn to accept, or are there things that perhaps we could do to get politicians to be more concerned with the good of the entire economy, even if it may be at the expense of their own constituents?
This is a really hard question, and I write about it somewhat in the book, and I've written about it before. We have 435 members of the House of Representatives. They each represent about 700,000 people. That group, as you say, is often going to have different interests, genuine interests. I'm not talking about those people getting confused, than the national average. That's common. Short of rewriting the Constitution, which is impossible, I hate to imagine how it would come out today. The hope is pinned, I think, not on the members of Congress so much as on the president and the vice president. They're elected by the whole country. They're the only people that are elected by the whole country. So you hope that a president will take the lead and push very hard, he or she, they've all been he so far, push very hard for the national interest, not for parochial, local interests. And, you know, a president is someone to be reckoned with. Secondarily, as you go down the ladder, and this is almost as far as you can go, you have the leadership of the Congress. So there's majority and minority leaders in both houses. They're supposed to be looking broadly. They don't care only about one congressional district. They care about their parties.
Sure.
And their parties are supposedly competing in every state and every congressional district. Now, we know, unfortunately, this is a bigger story about national partisanship and not about economics. There are many, many congressional districts and a whole number of states that are not competitive that way. They're one-party districts or they're one-party states. That's too bad. But so the one place where that gets aggregated, other than in the White House, is at the leadership of the political parties. They want to compete across the map, hopefully. And therefore, you hope that those people internalize the national interest more.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. Let's shift a little bit and talk about time horizons, because you spend a lot of time in your book discussing this.
Yeah.
You talk about how politicians are typically myopic in their decision making because they have to get reelected so often. And so they're generally focused on, you know, the next news cycle, and that economists tend to focus their analyses on equilibrium positions, essentially asking, you know, once all the dust has settled from a particular policy change, is the general public, you know, better off or worse?
Right.
So if this is true, and I think it is, and politicians are, you know, day by day concerned about the news cycle and the next election cycle, and they are constrained by, you know, artificial deadlines like the first 100 days of a presidency or whatever. Yeah. And yeah. Economists need rather longer time horizons to see how policies play out. How do these mindsets or approaches meet in order to build more effective policy?
The short answer is but I think there's actually some hope here because both have got it wrong. And it's obvious that they're wrong if it's only pointed out to them and they think about it a little bit. And the direction is obvious that the politicians' time horizons are too short and the economists are too long. Let me just elaborate a sentence or two on each. It is the nature of the beast that the president has a four-year time horizon. Senators have a six-year time horizon. Members of Congress have a two-year time horizon. That latter is unfortunately short, but at least it's 2 years, and it's not to tonight's news or till the next blog post goes up. It is really silly, and it's bad politics to let the deadline of what's going to be on the television in the next hour and a half, even if it's bad for you in the medium run, that is when you have to actually stand for re-election, which is not an hour and a half from now. So right. It's really bad politics to let yourself be whipsawed by that. You want to think about what's going to be good for you, or I should say, you want to think about what's going to be good for your constituents, because that probably will be good for you when you stand for re-election, which is on most days of the year, not tomorrow. Right. So a politician should be able to understand that. You could have a bad day on Wednesday and you're not running for re-election for a year and a half. On the economist side, as you said, most of my colleagues focus on equilibrium states, ignoring the fact that it may take 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years to get there. Well, people aren't going to be that patient. And that's A. And point B, it's not even good economics to ignore that, because right. There are going to be a lot of benefits and costs dispensed during the 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, as the economy traverses from one equilibrium to another equilibrium. So it's not good economics to ignore it, just as it's not good politics to act as if there's an election tomorrow. So I think there's some hope there if we can pound sense into the heads of both of those groups.
Right. Yeah, let's talk about a couple instances when politics and political messaging fostered bad policy. The first thing that always comes to my mind is, you know, when we ended bank bailouts through Dodd-Frank, you know, in the aftermath of 2008, everybody on the Hill was shouting, you know, we need to end too big to fail. We need to end bank bailouts. And then, you know, this was parroted all across the country. But, you know, for economists or, you know, those who understand banking and, you know, actually read all of Dodd-Frank, they know that while we did end bank bailouts, it was in fact the bailouts themselves that actually had saved our economy from collapse. But because of this overwhelming political pressure on politicians to end bailouts for, you know, millionaire bankers after the crisis, right. we no longer have an apparatus to rescue the banking system if we need to. I mean, we developed these things like the, you know, the orderly liquidation authority, where we can sell off assets, you know, as a bank is failing, and, you know, hopefully not shock the financial markets. But, you know, nobody really knows if that's going to be a smooth process when it happens. What we do know is that, you know, if we need to bail out a bank in order to stabilize the economy, we politicians, you know, can't do that. They are legally prohibited from doing so because of Dodd-Frank. So I guess what I'm asking is, how do we avoid situations like this? How do we avoid situations where politics forces policymakers to overreach and we end up with bad public policy because politicians feel that they have to do what their constituents want rather than what is actually best for them?
Yeah. It's a very hard question you ask. I do want to correct one misstatement that you made, is that Dodd-Frank didn't make it impossible to bail out banks or financial institutions in general. What it made it impossible to do is for the Fed to concentrate its fire on one institution. If the Federal Reserve feels that a whole class of banks or investment banks or insurance companies are all going down the tubes together, and this is going to be devastating for the economy, it can act the way it could have acted before Dodd-Frank. So it's a tougher standard, but it is still possible to, quote, bail out banks. Now, that word was very misused during the crisis. But that's part of my answer to you, that there is no panacea. It's like most of the questions you've been throwing at me. This is hard and doesn't have a perfect answer. But part of the answer is to explain yourself better. We came out of that episode that you're talking about with most of the Congress and most of their constituents thinking that the Treasury or the Fed, many of them didn't even draw a distinction between the two, had just shoveled money into the banks, taxpayer money, that you and I and Jane and John Doe had been fleeced and our money had been put into the banks. That's just not true.
No.
I mean, so if people just knew that, that would help already. So there's this sort of education, both broadly conceived, if people understood what was going on better, and narrowly conceived, if they actually knew what was done, rather than some of the myths that pervade the media. I mean, this was, I could blame this on the media, and some of it is, of course, justifiably blamed on the media. But I blame a lot of it on the policymakers who just didn't take the time to explain to the body politic what was going on, what was really going on, and why they were doing it. I mentioned before in answer to another question you asked that I wouldn't elect my fellow economists to public office. I don't think they'd be particularly good at this. A few would be, but most wouldn't be. But politicians are supposed to be good at explaining things to ordinary people. And that won't solve the whole problem, right, by no means. But I think it would help around the edges.
Certainly. You know, talking about politicians and their messaging, you know, one of the things that I fear, and I'm sure you do as well, is that the person with the loudest voice and the most Twitter followers will drive decision making going forward. Yep. You know, with most people getting their news from less than ideal sources such as Facebook and Twitter, zombie economics is not only a presence that we have to tolerate, it's becoming increasingly harder to fend off. And you know, you note this in the book about how in 2009, John Boehner, you know, labeled all of President Obama's spending programs as job killers, when, you know, we know that increased government spending leading to fewer jobs is pretty much mathematically impossible. And we can, you know, the same can be said for the tax cuts pay for themselves narrative of the political right. Any economist worth their salt would say that that's hogwash. But, you know, prominent people tout these beliefs, and when they do, many times it's accepted as fact. So are you as concerned as I am with social media and I guess, you know, quasi-news sources' impact on decision making, or do you feel that the media and the experts need to just do a better job disseminating the facts in the ways that the public can not only understand but also access?
I am very concerned with it. This is not a new phenomenon. Way back in the day, there was plenty of misinformation spread around and rumors and yellow journalism, they used to call it, and all kinds of things. Remember the Maine, for example? I mean, this is very, very old. It way predates electronic. It predates the internet, and it even predates electronic communications. But the internet has made it much, much easier to spread misinformation, crazy theories. What we started calling for a while under the Trump administration, alternative facts. That was a euphemism for lies. This isn't true, but I'll say it anyway. And the mainstream media at least has a kind of a filter. Let me give you a personal example. I write a monthly column in the Wall Street Journal. By the way, they're very good about letting me write what I want. So don't have the image that Rupert Murdoch is reading it, telling me you can't write that. They don't do that.
Right.
It's my thoughts. But a lot of the Wall Street Journal's readers lean far right. I lean more center left. And they disagree with me, many of them. Now, so here's now I come to the point. A little bit of that appears on the letters to the editor page. Those have been sifted through by rational people that work for the Wall Street Journal. And while they're critical of me and they're right-leaning rather than left-leaning, they're rational and they're not crazy. Read instead the blog that goes with online, where anybody, this is the way blogs are, anybody can just put anything on there, and there's no Wall Street Journal editor or any other editor to say, you can't say that, or that's wrong, or that's crazy, or that's nasty. There's no filter like that. And that's the sense in which the internet and social media have made it worse. There's no filter. There have always been bad journalists and bad editorial writers that wrote things that weren't right or were nasty or anything like that. I mean, a lot of us have read Hamilton. Hamilton and Jefferson were pretty nasty to each other.
Yeah.
So this is old, but the electronic media, spreading things through the internet, has just made it so much more pervasive and so much easier to do. It's a shame, and I don't, you know, you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about one of those sort of contentious issues. You know, we talked on it a little bit earlier, but let's talk a little bit more about trade. You know, one of the things that really stood out to me in your book, and I really appreciated, is how you not only highlighted the disconnect between economists and the average worker with respect to how each views the costs and benefits of trade, but you also note that we economists need to do a better job of recognizing and appreciating the transition costs of trade.
Yes.
We seem to always view international trade as a good thing because it leads to lower prices, increased, you know, economic efficiency, and eventually better jobs. And this mindset causes us to sort of dismiss the transition costs of trade and, you know, overlook the hardship workers face. You know, you say, quote, if most people consider themselves as workers first and consumers second, we economists have been barking up quite a few wrong trees for 200 years. Maybe it's we who need some illumination.
Yep.
And I think that's true. And I really appreciated, you know, you mentioning that. But what's the answer, though? I mean, it can't be a shift towards more protectionism. I mean, I know it's a difficult subject, but is it as simple as getting policymakers to allocate more funding for trade adjustment assistance? Is it something else entirely? I mean, it's, you know, in recent years, I mean, there's just been this sort of global push to be more, protectionist. And it's I think that's upsetting in some ways and challenging from a policy perspective.
Yeah, well, I came to that conclusion that you quoted very reluctantly. To economists, as you said, free trade is mother's milk. We think David Ricardo was one of the great figures in intellectual histories. That includes me. I'm not excluding myself from that. But I've come to realize over the years, this took me a long time, to see that that is the consumer perspective. The reason we think David Ricardo's insights and comparative advantage was so important is that it was a way to get the goods that people want to them more efficiently and more cheaply and raise their standards of living there by doing that. If it's the case that consumers care about that somewhat, they people rather pay less than more when they go to Walmart, but that is dwarfed in the minds of ordinary people by the worry about job loss because of the dislocations caused by trade. That's what I meant by barking up wrong trees. We could talk to a blue in the face about how you benefit from cheap stuff from China. And people do. It's true. We're not wrong about that. But if people look at that and say, okay, that's nickels and dimes, and what I really care about is my livelihood, and am I going to lose that into the maw of international trade, we're not going to win the argument. So this is very, very hard. It's not things that economists normally think. Trade adjustment assistance is at least barking up the right tree. It doesn't bark up very high. I'm really mixing metaphors here. Trade adjustment assistance is puny in America, both in terms of how many people it covers and in how many benefits they draw or can draw or eligible to draw. So I think that should be expanded greatly, both in quantity and in quality, and in general, give more assistance to people whose jobs are either lost or imperiled. That may be more generous unemployment insurance, that may be assistance in relocating geographically if you want to. Nobody's gonna force anybody to move. You know, another way to put this metaphorically is we economists say, you started with the industrial Midwest, jobs disappear in steel plants in Western Pennsylvania, but more jobs appear in Silicon Valley.
Right.
Well, that's great, but the guy in Pennsylvania is not moving to Silicon Valley.
Right.
And maybe we have to do something for him in Pennsylvania. So there's no panacea. I think this is about nibbling around the edges, but the important insight that I try to promote in the book, which most economists think, I would say most economists think it's crazy. I think most economists had never thought about at all.
Right.
Is that the welfare of individuals may not depend mainly on their consumption bundle. That's a very foreign thought in economics.
Right, right. Well, it seems that to address, many of the issues that we've touched on today, we have to get economists as well as policymakers to be aligned with regard to their time horizons. But we also need to find a way to reduce partisanship within the halls of Congress, because if we want to address serious issues like how to deal with the transition costs from trade, or actually passing a real tax reform package, or dealing, with income inequality, policymakers need to find a way to work together in a productive manner. Now, obviously, this is very difficult because our constitutional system was designed so that radical change couldn't take place overnight. But on some issues, we need radical change. And, you know, on others, like the, you know, the administration's push for infrastructure right now, you know, we can't keep kicking the can down the road, hoping our leaders find a way to come together and do their jobs. So what is your solution? What is one way where I guess we could sort of grease the wheels of Congress and start getting some of these things done?
I think this is really hard. I guess I'm giving the same answer to all questions. This is really hard. I talk in the book of what you just alluded to, what I call Madison's curse. Madison was a political genius, and he designed a great form of government. Look, we're still living with it all these years later. But I think he and his colleagues made a few big mistakes. One of them, well, I'm not going to go over the whole list, but one of them you basically were pushing there is they created a constitution that is essentially impossible to amend.
Right.
I mean, look at the history since the first Constitutional Convention. The first amendments came immediately. I think we have 28, right? If I got that, I may be off by one. I think we have 28 in the whole history. Forget about the 10. They were in there right from the get-go.
Right.
You know, the next day, not the next day, the next, you know, immediately. Two of them are prohibition and it's repeal. So that's plus one, minus one. That's nothing. So the Constitution has basically been amended 16 times in the entire history since then. There are a whole list of things I could give you that require amendments to the Constitution. I alluded to one already. I think it's borderline nutty that members of the House only have a 2-year term.
Right.
They're running for office every single day. They start the next day running. That's crazy. Maybe it wasn't crazy in Madison's time, but it's crazy in this time. But we're never going to change that. You have to amend the Constitution to change that. Similarly, we're never going to change, and this is going to bring me to the point of something I think we can change with enormous difficulty. We're never going to change the constitutional gerrymander that is the United States Senate, right? Wyoming, a wonderful state, I visited there a few times, I love going to Wyoming, has the same number of senators as California. I mean, is that crazy or what? But we're never, ever going to change that. Gerrymandering in the House, there's at least, you can come up for air and get some hope. Very, very hard because it has many entrenched defenders, and anything you want to do, this is a zero-sum game. Right? If you make a change that's going to be good for some people, it's going to be bad for other people. So very, very difficult. But there are at least a few states in the union that have moved in the direction of more technocratic congressional districts rather than have the politicians gerrymander them every 10 years. So I think that's very important and, you know, borderline doable. A prayer, a wing and a prayer doable, unlike amending the Constitution. The second thing that I think is a wing and a prayer doable, but this is going to require a new Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court moves slowly, is, you know, people point a lot at Citizens United. I say, you're looking at a symptom. The real problem was the decision, I believe is in 1976, and I think it was Buckley versus Valeo. I'm not sure I'm right about that. I think so. Which equated speech and money.
Right.
Free speech, spending money and free speech are the same. Man, if you would have told James Madison that, he would have said, are you an American? I mean, what in the world are you thinking? The founders, I'm sure, never thought. They believed in free speech. But I'm pretty sure they never thought of it as free expenditures of money. So until we take much of the money out of politics, and we can't do that without a change in that Supreme Court ruling in 1976, it's going to be very difficult. But that's why I put this on the, you know, come up for a last gasp of water.
Yeah.
It's not completely impossible.
Right. Right. Well, you know, Professor, before I let you go, I want to ask you a final question. I know you're very busy, and I don't want to take up too much of your time. We've touched on quite a bit today, but I think, you know, what our listeners really want to know is, you know, what role, you know, economists should play in the political process. In your opinion, you know, you've seen it all, you've been through it all, you know better than anyone. How would you like to see economists utilized in the political arena for, you know, the greatest good?
Well, I think the way I want to answer that question is, I draw an analogy. I often talk to my students about the interesting, and by the way, I've learned over the years, this is true in most languages on the planet. There are two very different meanings of the verb to listen. So you can listen to a podcast.
Right.
Or you can listen to your mother. We use the same verb. They mean very, very different things. The politicians are never going to listen to economists the way they listen to their mother. I'd like to see them listen to economists more the way they listen to a podcast or the radio or the television. Gather information, think about it, think about whether that makes sense, and listen in that sense. That doesn't mean they're always going to do what economists think they should do, but I think if they would do that more, and if, by the way, if economists would be better on the other end, we could get somewhat better economic policy than we are getting now.
Yeah. Well, Professor Blinder, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today. I know our listeners and I have learned very much from you, and we thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us.
Glad to be there with you. Thank you.
If you want to get more Alan Blinder, his book, Advice and Dissent, is available for purchase on the Demand Side's library page. And if you want to access all of Professor Blinder's research, visit princeton.edu/Blinder. Professor Blinder, thank you again.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for us here at the Demand Side. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Why Politicians Ignore Economists with our very special guest, Alan Blinder. Make sure to check out all the episodes of The Demand Side on The Demand Side's landing page, wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to visit TheDemandSide.com for access to opinion pieces, books, news, and videos. Thank you all for joining us today. And remember, if you're forced to choose sides, always choose The Demand Side. Until next time.